Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
June 23rd, 2019, and welcome to episode 194 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and things that you just don't know if they're old enough to be collected. Speaking of not old enough to be collected, hello, Carrington. How are you today?
Oh, I'm so old enough to be collected. I'm totally collectible. It's one of a kind.
Excellent.
I hope.
Not like a set? Collect all four? Kind of?
Nope.
Just one Carrington?
Well, actually, there are five of us, and we can form Voltron, so I'm changing my message.
Nice.
That is so cool.
And you doing good, eh?
I am. I'm out there fighting crime.
Nice. What about you, Jack? All the way from Sweden.
I'm doing good. Enjoying nice summer weather here, and yeah.
You just had midsummer thingy, right?
We did. This Friday was Midsummer Eve.
Northern Hemisphere for the win!
Yes. And so the nights are very, very long now, the sun, the days are long, is what we say, because the sun is
right.
Up all the time. So,
yep.
So, like, as we're recording this right now, it's about 10:30 p.m., and it looks like just barely, like, the sun has just barely set, and it's, like, it will get gradually darker over the next couple hours, but never will be quite dark, and then a couple hours from now, it'll start to get lighter again.
That is so cool.
It is pretty cool. These days, I'm actually pulling my blackout curtains all the time so I can sleep at night, because it's kind of driving me nuts.
Also protects you from bombings.
Yes, that too. And x-rays.
I hadn't heard that, but yeah, that's a very good idea. Well, since you have the mic there, Paul, you don't have the latitude, but you got the attitude. What's going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, my neck of the woods has shifted north a little bit. I'm recording from Montreal. But it's very nice here.
Oh, so. Well, very good. You've got a little more latitude than normal, I guess, then, eh?
Indeed. And A becomes ever more appropriate.
Earl is southernmost. Nice. That's the switch. Normally, somebody else is south.
I know.
South
Aurora. That is so weird. I'm in the Pacific Northwest. I'm not supposed to be the southernmost. Well, that's okay. I'll go with it. So it's good to hear everybody. Great to be behind the mic with y'all again. I have to say y'all because I'm the southernmost
nice.
Person here. And today we do have a host topic, as you know, like we do. And today's is challenges of the more recently obsolete. So, you know, you collect this stuff, and some of it's like really old, and then some of it's not quite so old. So I have some things like that in my collection, but I'll go last. So here's the setup. A bunch of older computers. Think, you know, like eMate, old iMacs. I can't believe that the flavored iMacs are actually getting to the point where they're old enough to be retro. But so these things, they might, maybe they have wireless, maybe they got, you know, Ethernet, stuff like that. But, you know, they're starting to get old enough where they're increasingly unsupported. So we'll go around the table and talk about if you have anything like that in your collection, and what sort of kludges or, you know, special sort of things have you had to buy or build or do to play with this stuff? So, Jack, why don't we start with you? Do you have anything in your collection that's like a tweener?
I really don't. I think that the things that I've had in my collection are all, you know, before the advent of popular home networking. So it's not really... a thing where they could network with stuff at one point and now they can't. You know, so like things like an Atari 8-bit computer. You know, well, sure, you could call things with a modem. But of course, as we've talked about many times, the nice thing with all these old machines that as long as you have a serial port, you can attach some kind of serial Wi-Fi adapter thingy, and suddenly you're actually on the internet with an old computer. So that has actually opened up in a way compared to the way things used to be. But I've never, like, I don't really have any, the only computers I have that are really newer than that, say newer than early 80s, are things that just have Ethernet or Wi-Fi in them.
Mm.
I don't have to deal with anything like, you know, strange Apple talk, or I know we've talked sometimes about devices where, oh, this thing used to connect to the internet, but it requires a certain server somewhere to do its actual back-end stuff somehow, which is now gone. I just don't have any of that.
Hmm.
I'm free.
Nice. Very nice. But Paul, I know you do.
Yeah, I played around with some of this stuff a little bit. And you know, that was partly what made me think about it, is that there are things like the old Newton computers, or I have a Palm OS device of a relatively recent vintage called a Dana Wireless, that, you know, and these things are intrinsically capable of connecting to Wi-Fi, but of course it's very low power Wi-Fi with low power encryption that, you know, no servers allow for anymore. So I know I've said a couple of times I've tried to set up like a bridge machine that would send out. I actually don't even know the encryption technologies. You know, WEP, is that a low power one?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so it would, even though the sort of surrounding network isn't capable of going that low, I can set up a machine that can connect to that and then send out a lower power signal. I've succeeded in that a couple of times, but yeah, I sort of have to figure it out again every time, and I do this once every like year and a half.
It seems like you could get by just having an old wireless router of some kind that is, you know, plugged into a fixed Ethernet line somewhere for its upstream connection, and it vends a, you know, an old 802.11b mm-hmm. connection to whatever can use that.
And then at some point, the internet notices
it. Right, and then suddenly you are attacked from all sides.
Well, but, you know, but this router would still be behind your main router's firewall.
Yeah.
You know, so wait,
you guys have firewalls?
Yeah, I mean, the only problem with that is that if, you know, once enough traffic has passed on a WEP secured network, it's no longer secured anymore. You can
right. You
can listen to that traffic and then decode it, unfortunately. But I guess what you're saying, Jack, is that you're going to insulate that network from the rest of your mainstream network, and you would just have the older stuff on there that just doesn't know any better.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you can do things like surfing whatever resources you can get to from your Newton or your Palm OS device, and it shouldn't affect anything else because you won't be talking between that computer and anything else on your network if you're just bouncing everything out to the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That makes sense. Was that it for you, Paul, on that, or did you have any more comments?
There are a few other things I will probably add in. We can circle back around to me if you want.
Sure. Well, Carrington, I know your collection is kind of minimalist, so I'm guessing you don't have any of that middle ground stuff in the collection, but, you know, who knows?
Well, no, and I haven't even previously when I had more items, because the things that I'm interested in collecting-wise when it comes to retro computers all predate the internet. Like, I am a late 70s, early 80s interested kind of guy. Although lately I've been kind of enjoying 90s games and things, but for the most part, it's all pre-internet things. So it's getting Wi-Fi connections. I kind of use my stuff in isolation. Like, I just want an Apple II and play games on it, and it's less about even networking. I do have to deal with this a bit more when it comes to work, so more recently obsoleted things, when suddenly, you know, you switch protocols or somebody gets a new computer and they didn't know there wouldn't be a CD-ROM drive in it or something. I'm like, what do you mean you thought there'd be a CD-ROM drive? Come on, Gramps. So I deal with that sort of stuff at work, when people are surprised by suddenly certain ports don't exist anymore, or the way they're you upgrade your computer and now their printer can't talk to it anymore because it was on some weird thing or whatever. So it's more about near-term obsolescence, and that's the stuff I deal with all the time, and it's such a pain. The last thing I would want to do is have that be an element in my retro collecting fun. Just not interested at all. Also, though, generally when I'm faced with stuff like this, I just do an end run around it. Like, I won't try to figure out how to get a Wi-Fi thing working or whatever. I'll say, what can this computer do that is more of an open standard? Do you have an Ethernet port? Yeah, well, then you're off Wi-Fi and now you're using a cable. Like, just that sort of thing. I'll ignore Apple Talk and just go for a different protocol. So I'm just generally too lazy to struggle with these things.
Well,
laziness is the key.
Well, it makes sense. You don't want to have stuff that's just going to be frustrating. I've got some machines in my collection that I do have a certain attachment to, some Unix boxes from the mid-90s era. And kind of why I like those or have some nostalgia. In the mid-90s, I worked for a router and switch company for a while, internetworking, and we had Unix boxes of the time. And then after that, when I moved up here to Portland, I worked for an electronic design automation company, and we had Unix boxes scattered all over the place, HP systems and Sun systems. And so I got some familiarity with those, and I really liked them. And then somebody here on Craigslist a few years ago had some, so I bottom up for practically nothing. And they're interesting in that they have twisted pair Ethernet and they understand X Windows in terms of a graphical user interface. But I mean, they're way behind where we are today. So they have some interesting challenges in dealing with them. Like, the video on a couple of them is that weird 13W3 connector. I don't know if you guys know what I mean, but it's this weird kind of connector with three circular things in it and some other pins and stuff.
Oh, right. That thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just, and you know, the sync signal on those was often something called sync on green, which means that you have to have a VGA monitor. If you want to convert that to VGA, you got to have a VGA monitor that understands sync on green. So just these weird little idiosyncrasies, and they all had their own keyboards with their own kind of connection standards and that kind of thing. So that's a little bit of a pain. It's still fun to play with them, but, you know, so they're not quite old enough to be super retro. They are old enough to be interesting to me, but they're also just skating right on the line of when some of our modern networking standards, that none of them have Wi-Fi, so I don't even have to worry about that. But I think one of them might just be 10 base T, you know, so just 10 megabit Ethernet, and not all switches are terribly happy with that. Sometimes you plug into some of these cheap $20 Ethernet switches and they're like, the what now?
Get your jalopy off my network.
Exactly. Sorry,
buddy.
I guess
we're lucky in a sense, if you're like older, and this, so the stuff you have nostalgia for, if it's old enough, then, well, we have to deal with like capacitors blowing up and that sort of thing, but they are such simpler systems. People who will have nostalgia, you know, 30 years from now for stuff today, it's all going to be things that are DRM based and the servers are gone and maybe it's illegal to have copied them. They're all going to be like, oh, I have nostalgia for all the phone games I played. Well, that platform is completely gone and the store that sold to you is completely gone and you couldn't back up any of the things. And so we're kind of fortunate in that we even have access to the stuff at all. So go us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, if my son, you know, he likes games like Overwatch and CSGO and stuff like that, and in the future just ain't going to be there. There won't be any way to re-enjoy that unless somebody pulls a rabbit out of their hat.
Well, I guess you could watch recordings of people's Let's Play videos. So you can't play it anymore, but you could watch somebody having played it. So there's that.
You could. And, you know, I mean, that seems like a pale sort of comparison, but right now he actually likes watching some of those. I mean, today, modern day. So I guess that would.
Because we're nerds. Pale is what we do.
We do. I have a hacker tan. So Paul, we're going to cycle back to you because you had some more stuff.
Oh yeah. Well, I was just thinking, when you were talking about these Unix boxes, that reminds me a lot of the kind of challenges you have with Next stations too. I mean, like with the monitor as well. You know, there's like a small list of monitors that you can use with the Next. But it also has the same, like, I don't even understand the networking. I was trying to remember what this was called. There's something like, there's something that has the word directory in it that used to be in the very ancient Mac OS X stuff, and then and it, you know, the next has to do it too, and I don't really remember how it even works.
Oh, right. Yeah, like I remember we used to do back at Carlton was we would get a new Next slab, and we'd have to like take the Ethernet address that was like, I think it was printed on the bottom of the machine or something, and we'd run a networking utility of some kind on one of the Next that was a server and say, hey, this new machine is one of ours. And then when it would, you put on the network and it would boot up and it would somehow find this, the actual server, and it would say, yeah, okay, you're one of ours. Mm-hmm. I'll let you do your thing. I remember it, but I don't remember what it was called either.
NetInfo was the thing I was thinking of.
That sounds right.
But I'm also reminded too when I look at the stuff that, you know, it was hard to figure out at the time. Now, you know, we are all much more advanced in our ways of networking, but it's still hard to figure out now. I mean, it hasn't gotten easier. It's still as complicated as it ever was.
So, question though, Carrington, in your minimalist mm-hmm. collection, don't you have a Mac that has an Apple II card in it?
Used to.
Oh, you don't have that anymore. So
Nah. Everything goes away. I had an LC475 with the 2E card, which is a very sweet setup. Lovely, lovely computer.
So the LC475, did that have twisted pair Ethernet built right into it?
No, you could put a card in, but why would I do that when I had the Apple II card? You got to make your choices, man.
Sure.
It has a SCSI port, though, so you could use a SCSI adapter to add Ethernet in, which is what I think most people would do. Mm-hmm. Because that slot is only good for one thing, my friends, Apple IIe compatibility.
So that really wasn't a tweener computer itself. I mean, that was probably just old enough to be not in the range that we're talking about here.
But it did do Apple Talk. So,
yes.
You know, and there is a... I have had a little bit of experience with something called NetAtalk, which is kind of like a more modern AppleTalk protocol emulator.
My gosh, I fought so hard to get that thing to work. When you say NetAtalk, I want to go jump into a foxhole somewhere and cry.
Sorry. Yeah, I actually used... There's a package that Ivan Drucker, I think, put together mainly for booting Apple IIs over a network. And I was able to just use that. My Macs were able to talk to it. So I didn't actually do a lot of the configuration myself. Someone else did. But that is super cool, actually, like starting an Apple II over a network on a drive that I can access like from my laptop. You know, so I can change stuff.
If you do that, though, with the Apple II, you must have that one of the cards that they talked about, or some sort of a... You must have something, right,
oh, yeah,
to be able to boot that. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a actually relatively rare now card called the Workstation card.
Right. They're pricey.
Essentially what it does is just gives you AppleTalk access. I actually looked that up on eBay, and the last one that sold was, I think... I mean, there's none currently listed. You know, there's like three that have been available in the last like 3-4 months or something like that. And I think the last one that sold was something like $250 or something. They're non-trivial to get.
That's the thing. I got so excited when I saw the package that Ivan Drucker had put together. I was like, this is great. You can run this on a Raspberry Pi. You can boot your Apple II from it. And wait, I got to have a what? And it's going to cost what?
Right.
So that was the only unfortunate part of that. But it looks like a really cool package of stuff. You boot ProDOS from it, right? On your Apple II, and away you go.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
All right, well, we're a little bit off the rails here. Anything else from anybody on this particular topic?
I put a couple of links in the show notes, which will be there for those of you listening, that describe putting a Newton or an eMate 300 on a Wi-Fi network, because it's sort of interesting to just, I mean, there are a couple of people who've posted about this. This particular link has a list of wireless cards that work. So I think, I'm pretty sure I have actually succeeded once briefly to do this. But I know that I was, you know, I searched around for a while to get the right Orinoco card or whatever it is that you can put in the eMate. And I think the Alpha Smart Dana was, that was a little bit easier because it's built in, but again, you need to know how to connect to whatever the Wi-Fi station is, and you have to have one that's sort of capable of going down enough. So if you happen to have either one of those things, there is a link in the show notes that will help you do this. And it's kind of cool to be able to like sit on a chair disconnected from everything and type on your eMate.
Nice.
15 whole minutes of fun, you know.
Perfect.
Well, okay. I guess we can move on to feedback. And Paul, if you want to do your, you know, normal excellent roundup of this, who's talking to us?
Sure. I will talk a little bit about that. So Klaus has written a couple of things. First, actually, over email, he sent us a nice self-introduction. I won't review it all here, but that was pretty cool. He said that he started out with a Memotech MTX512, which is a British computer that is internally similar to a ColecoVision, to a Sega SG-1000, and a Sword M5. So, again, the Sword comes up. He said he tries to make it to MemoFest in the UK every year if he can. And I will just note that that means there is an annual MemoFest in the UK.
I was about to say, well, that's news to me.
So,
yeah.
I didn't go as far as to look it up, but I think it's a relatively small gathering, but there exist Memotech devotees.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and maybe some of them are listening to this podcast and don't know that there is a MemoFest.
That's true.
We may be bridging worlds here.
I just found a site that has some recaps for MemoFest 2013, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18.
That's cool.
Yep, there is so much going on that I do not know. I'll stick this link in the show notes.
Nice.
Excellent. But Klaus had started listening to our old episodes. So there's a thing that's come up a couple of times. It turns out it's actually kind of hard to get a hold of episodes of the Retro Computing Roundtable that are older than like about the last 30, I think, or something like that. And it turns out that it's not that we actually failed to check to see if we could just bump up the number, but the version of Squarespace that our site is on, that's the limit. So either we have to migrate to a new version of Squarespace or migrate
ding ding ding
or migrate away from Squarespace to something else or whatever. But
and we have a winner.
So anyway, so once we do that, it'll be more than 30.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I've been planning on actually just sort of like zipping them up into some kind of a package so that at least you could download them if you wanted to. But at least we do hope that sometime before maybe like the summer ends, there will be a longer feed. But
and we also hope that we figure out how to do that with the feed without making 150 new episodes of RCR magically appear on your podcatcher.
Right.
Worth every bite.
That's true.
They'll take them and they'll like them.
but
yeah, what we really need to do is separate our hosting, our RSS feed from our hosting, of course, obviously, whether or not we stay on Squarespace. That's how we do it on every other show. We're just, you know, it's an old school podcast and we still do things an old school way.
We chisel our MP3s into actual granite.
Painstaking process.
So sort of connected to Klaus going through and listening to the old things, he has a comment on something we talked about on episode 5. So, for those of you who remember episode 5, he said, you talk about early app stores, and I think one of the earliest ones might be the Play Cable from Intellivision. He said he's not sure of the year, but you could download games from your cable provider, and he never saw it in action. Has anyone had any experience with that?
Mm-mm. Sounds cool.
It does sound cool, yeah. It's amazing that it would be available as old as the television is. Anyway, interesting.
I remember there were some fairly advanced technology attempts in early 80s cable television stuff. Like I remember, I think it was when I lived in Nebraska at the time when I was only 9 or 10 and a friend had cable TV at home and they had something where like I think maybe we were in a test market for something where there was some kind of interactive program where you could like maybe there's a game show or something, you could kind of press A, B, or C on some kind of remote. It was a wired remote. But like, I remember the things were being tested out that were never maybe went mainstream. But
it sounds like you had an older brother who convinced you that if you held the remote while you're watching TV, it like did things. I'm pretty sure you were just punked, Jack.
Damn it.
He also stood behind the keyboard machine and kicked it and swore at you.
That's right.
Anyway, yeah, so I think that's interesting. It also reminds me a little bit of the, and now I've forgotten even what it's called, but there was I think it was for the Atari 2600, like a cartridge expander that used cassette tape to load in to extra memory. Does this sound familiar?
Yeah. I think it's called the StarPath Supercharger.
That sounds right. But presumably that kind of thing would work if the signal was sent over a cable.
Right.
Anyway. Okay, so Bob wrote over email to mention that the Radio Shack MathMile computer that we talked about, I think, last time, it seems to be a simplified version of the E6B flight computer used since the 40s in aviation for similar time, distance, and fuel computations. So that's cool. Also suggests that the E6B might have been informally known as the Exidy Sorcerer. Which I like very much.
Well played. Yeah.
Let's see. Okay, so... oh, and yeah, I don't think we ever talked about this before either, but Stephen wrote over email to point out a retro computing themed game in which you play as a 80s, 90s type hacker on retro computers, which includes programming actual code. It's like a real game that you can buy on like, I think it's on Steam and Good Old Games, and it's called Exapunks. And it looks, I haven't actually checked to see like how expensive it is or anything, but it looks like basically like a screen full of many terminals, and you do stuff like hack banks and write viruses, and I think there's something that's supposed to be sort of like biohacking. I'm not sure exactly how that works.
It looks super cool.
It does look
and
neat.
The same company behind it is called Zachtronics. I think we've talked about one or two of their other games. They had this one called Shenzhen IO. Mm-hmm. And one called TAS 100, which were both also games about programming, where you do programming in the game. Now, I haven't played either of these, but I'm pretty sure we talked about one or the other of them at some point in the past. But this new one looks even cooler.
Yeah. There are, and part of the, like the first bullet point says you get to read zines, you know? So like there are like little print right. publications of a sort that you are reading through to learn how to do all your hacking.
I feel seen.
So this is how I can teach the next generation. You know, like this is what it was like.
Yep, it looks pretty cool.
Okay, and then Tony wrote over email to point out a BBC Four podcast series called Computing Britain. I have been I've been completely unaware of this, but apparently the latest episode talks about the history of the ARM chip, and it also looks like the next couple will be interesting too. The latest one is let's see. It says the latest one, but then it also says broadcast Friday, 25th, September, 2015. So perhaps it's not actually all that recent, but nevertheless, there seem to be 12. The Mobile Revolution one is the one that we were pointed to. And it looks like there's another couple. The two after that are Omnibus 1940s to 1970s and Omnibus 1980s onward. So does anyone have any idea? Are these 4 years old or are they current? I think they're 4 years old.
I think they're from 2012 originally, but these look great and I was unaware of them. So I don't care how old they were. I want to listen.
Right, they're about things
Me
from
too.
The 1940s, you know, whatever.
Am I going to be able to listen though? Because sometimes the beeb like cuts me off.
They're just online.
Okay.
Good. Grab them. Yeah. I have downloaded them all while we speak, just nice. In case.
But you're in Canada. So you,
I am
you, subject to
the queen and all.
You could maybe. I'm going to try. I'll let you know if I get like geo blocked
by Her Majesty herself. Phone rings. We are not permitting you to download.
Let's see what's left. Oh, okay. Also, over email. Yeah, several emails left. Okay, so James sent a photo of the VidHD operating on two screens at once. So. Proof of concept, it can be done. We talked about the VidHD as like Apple II video card. So that's good. Nathan wrote over email to point out that the Epson site not only has a bunch of new printers, which was a marvelous discovery of one of the recent episodes, but it actually still has all the old manuals too. He said as far back as the MX-70 from, I think it was 1981, if I copied that down right.
Nice. Although that is stuff no doubt to grab and get into the Internet Archive. Well, they've got them on there now. I bet they won't forever. Yeah. So nice, though. That's very cool.
Yeah, that reminds me. Actually, Apple had, for the longest time, done a great thing, which is they had this, I forget even what it was called, but it was like support.apple.com .net or something. There was an FTP accessible site, and I think it was also had a HTML front end, but that had all of the old system disks and, you know, all kinds of all the updates and things. There were like a couple things that they didn't have. You couldn't get, I think, like 9.2 or something wasn't available that way, or there was a couple things that you couldn't get, but it was a huge, wonderful archive, and it went away like probably 2 or 3 years ago now.
I remember that, yeah. Because you used to be able to get like 7.5.5, but not 7.6 or something. It was some weird holes in it, yeah.
Yeah, and it was great, and then it wasn't there. So you can get a lot of that same stuff on the Internet Archive now. There were a couple of captures made of it, but so grab the Epson stuff is the moral of that story.
Morals? I'm out.
Nope.
So that's interesting about all those old manuals. I notice also Toshiba seems to have pretty good support for their old stuff. I have a mid-90s, talking about tweener computers, I have a mid-90s Pentium Toshiba laptop, and you could still download all the NT4 drivers, the Windows 98 drivers, the documentation, all up there on Toshiba's site, so yay them.
Because you got to think, like, how little space this stuff takes. Like, the PDF of a current Toshiba computer's manual will be larger than the entire vintage archive. So, like, why not just throw that stuff up there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are definitely a lot of people who appreciate it. But on the other hand, you know, it's like the whatever web development intern who graduated 3 years ago isn't gonna notice or care if that stuff gets lost.
Yeah. This is true.
So. Okay, let's see. And then the last thing that we got was an email from Dominic, who wanted to point us to a site, vintagecomputer.ca, which has a lot of interesting photos and things on it. And I think we have...
Did we talk about
because
this?
Because I remember the Microcomputer Machines 70, specifically.
I just remember how beautiful the photos are, so it's kind of ringing a bell, I think.
Yeah, so I think we've seen it before, but good, it's... You know, worth reminding people. And if you,
I know, even just browsing it now, it's so beautiful.
And if you want to see the Microcomputer Machines MCM70, the Canadian Holy Grail of computing history, is a wonderful looking machine that it looks. I can't look at this and not just see like a face.
Right. I feel like it's staring into the sun, or squinting into the sun.
And it has like the little eyes flip up like, you know, sunglasses. It's wonderful. Anyway, yes, thank you for the reminder, Dominic. That was great. And I think that that'll exhaust our feedback for today.
All right. Well, then it sounds like we have to talk about some news or something. And if that's the case, I'm going to reluctantly throw it over to Carrington.
Always reluctantly. This TRS-80 is the title of the first thing I have for you guys. It's an article by Wayne Lorentz, and it is an example of like the best kind of retro/tech-heavy description of something. So it talks about how there's lots of TRS-80 models, and there were lots of Model 100s and whatever. And so this is a person writing about the Model 100 that they owned back in the day, but in a very specific personal way. It was a tech reporter, and so it talks about using it as a reporter's tool, and that's kind of the thing it was known for. If you could upgrade from pencil and paper back then, you could use a Model 100 if you're a reporter. And so it talks about using the Model 100 and what it was for, and a bunch of things came out of it that I didn't know before. So if you're interested in the Model 100, it's definitely an article worth reading, because it talks about it specifically and the specific software that he used and all of that. But even if you're less interested in the Model 100, it has some great points about computers that I don't really see brought up in a lot of places. Like, there was this real period for a while where people were more likely to have a computer at home than at work. And so he went through this period where people, especially reporters, if they were using a computer at their desk, they had a typewriter, but they would buy their own computer and that they would use, and you could do stuff at home, you could maybe bring it to work or whatever, but if you had a computer, you were using it at work fashion, more likely it was your own thing you had just brought to the job. And so that was an interesting thing that I don't see mentioned, because I remember that as well. I remember that small period. And often with jobs, I've wished I could bring my own computer instead of use the one that's been pushed on me. Also talks about the AP Newswire, which I've heard of the Associated Press before, but I didn't realize there was, like, at least at the time, an A and a B feed, and the B was for broadcast and A was really for newspapers. So there'd be the big news reports. It might be like a 40 or 50 page a thing would come off your teletype if you were the A feed, but it would only be a 3 or 4 page version if it was the B feed. And they would have a version of it that was pre-formatted, so lazy people could just take it and read it exactly as it is on air, which is why you'll have so many different broadcasters give the exact same report, because they're simply reading it verbatim from the B feed and have horoscopes. And that's it. It was just like this whole look into the way the newswires worked at the time and the way somebody in the late 70s or early 80s might use computers in a news fashion, and talked about how people would only use pencils instead of pens for particular reasons. And just, it was really interesting. So it was interesting because it has a ton of stuff about the TRS-80 Model 100, which is a cool computer. But also I found it fascinating for this glimpse into specifically how that computer was used in a specific industry at the time, in a very personal sort of write-up. It fascinating, really well written, and highly recommended. So we will have that link in the show notes.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome write-up and awesome coverage of that, Carrington. I'm going to have to take back my reluctant comment. Well, all right. I guess I've got the next one. I want to talk about CPM-ish. So there's an open source reimplementation kind of slash clone of CPM 2.2. It's an awesome project, and part of the reason that it's awesome is because all the components of it are under some sort of open source available license. That is, they're either GPL or BSD or just flat out in public domain. It turns out, I mean, you can go out and you can get CPM, the digital research versions of it. You can look at some of the source code, but it all remains encumbered under this litany of licenses. And I mean, it's been so long since I researched this, I don't even remember it all. But like many of the old computing properties, it went through several hands and, you know, got mangled along the way. Whereas this implementation of CPM, a clone of CPM, it has no such issues, and the source code for every single piece of it is available, which also means you could bundle it and give it away as part of an emulator if you wanted to, or you can freely play with all the pieces of it. So kind of fun. And there are a couple of specific machines that it's been implemented on. At least one of those machines has an emulator, the K-Pro 2. Apparently MAME has an emulator for it. It seems like MAME has an emulator for everything. So as part of this CPM-ish, there's instructions in the website on how you can take a look at this CPM-like operating system using that K-Pro 2 emulator. I just liked everything about this. It just got updated over the last few days. Apparently, they went to the people who made BBC Basic, and they said, hey, would you be okay with open sourcing this? And the person who made it said, yes, I would be okay with that. So a really cool part of computing history got open sourced as part of this whole effort to give you a full system that you could play with. So we'll have a link for the GitHub site up in the show notes. From that GitHub site, you can pivot over to the actual website and blog of the implementer who's doing all this cool work. I found out about it from a posting on the newsgroup comp.os.cpm, which I am an occasional lurker in because I love CPM. So that's that.
I'd like to point out, I think it's pronounced JitHub.
So moving on.
No, that looks really cool. And I was looking at the page, and one of the links on the page was to, it said something like, hey, this is actually a pretty good thing because the Z80 is a common target for homebrew computers, and CPM is the obvious operating system to run on one. Don't believe me? Watch this. And there's a link to a video, And I haven't listened to it because I've only just paged through it while listening to you speak. And it's someone opening up a small laptop of some kind. It's an Amstrad of some kind, like smaller than most like notebook computers today, with a tiny screen and a nice looking keyboard. And he powers it up and it's running some kind of CPM, I guess. Did you see this? It looks pretty cool.
I saw the link to the video, but I didn't watch it.
I would guess that it is the Amstrad NC200, one of the two platforms.
Yes. Yes, it is. I see it now. Cool. It's a pretty cool looking little piece of hardware. Do you know when that came out? Do you remember at all, Paul? Any rough idea?
I have no clue. Let's see.
Well, having a Z80 laptop was kind of early to mid 80s. Did anybody even make any like after that? The Epson Geneva, the PX8, is the latest one that I know about.
It says the NC200 appeared in late 1993.
What?
That is late. That is very late.
And yet, it's got this CPM-ish operating system running on it, which is super cool. And the site is also correct in that there's tons of Z80 homebrew or, you know, design stuff that's still going on today. So, nice.
Well, yeah, and I believe that people run CPM on these things even without the license, you know? So.
Sure.
Well, I think you can do that. I think that's actually okay. The issue is, though, that it is still technically encumbered by that, you know, waterfall of licensing stuff that CPM went through in its last gasping for air days. So we'll have a link also for that video up in the show notes. All right. Well, Paul, let's move over to you. You've got the next item about a basic historical marker.
Yep. And that's actually almost all that there is to say about it. But we mentioned, I think, that this was going to go up, and it has now actually gone up. There's an article in The Verge that has a picture of this marker. It is on, what is it? It says it is on New Hampshire Route 120, a short distance away from the college, Dartmouth College, where BASIC was created. And it says BASIC, the first user-friendly computer programming language, on a big like roadside sign, and gives a, you know, short, I know what that is, like 15 line paragraph talking about the history of BASIC. So it's kind of cool that they decided this was worthy of mention. And so now it's actually there and you can drive to see it if you want.
And steal it.
No.
I mean, see it. Totally what I meant.
That's nice to commemorate that like that. Very cool.
Yeah, it is cool. I'm trying to think if there's like some sort of like basic themed joke you could play on it, but I nothing's coming to mind. So.
Well, of course, there's that other dude. Was it Alan Kay? I don't want to, you know, misquote titans of our computing industry, but one of the folks from the old days said that anyone who learned BASIC had their brain sufficiently rotted that they would then be useless for anything else. I can't remember who said that. But I don't feel like that's true because, you know, I learned BASIC pretty early on and, you know, I'm only half mutated.
You keep people on the road forever by making another sign just past it that just says 20 go to sign.
Right. Yes, see, that's the kind of thing I was thinking about. Very well done.
Okay.
All right. Well, so Carrington, you want to tell us about?
Don't even spoil it. I got a great one for you guys.
All right,
a great one. So this is similar to the TRS-80 Model 100 one I talked about, where it was very personal, which is such an. I mean, it's great to read about stats and such when it comes to computers, but the things that will really grip me sometimes when it's somebody's very personal recollection of something where you're not just getting the history or the numbers, you're also getting like the flavor of a particular person's point of view. So this little flavor journey I'm going to paint for you begins on Montuli.org, which is a page, little website set up for people with the name Montuli. So every once in a while, if you've got a strange name, people will put up stuff like that. And so it says, this is a selfishly dedicated site to finding information about people whose last name is Montuli. Now, so it lists a bunch of members. First person list is Louis J. Montuli II. And in parentheses, it says, the Netscape guy. So if you click on that, you find out about this Netscape guy. So Lou Montulli basically was the engineer behind Netscape, the first bunch of revisions of it. He worked on Linux before that, did a bunch of net things, and he's largely, he even says, largely to blame for things like introducing cookies to the web and server push and pull and server push and client pull stuff, HTTP proxying, HTTPS over SSL, like a whole bunch of things like that early on when he was working on Netscape Navigator. But maybe most famously or infamously, he's basically the person behind the blink tag. So if you go, he's got a whole write-up on the origins of the blink tag, where it came from, why it was around, and how it was essentially a joke. People stayed up late, were talking about things you could do, and being a person who worked on Lynx, which is a text-only browser, and now he's working on Netscape Navigator, and you know, all the lovely things that come from that, being very graphics-oriented and having, I'm going to avoid the controversy and just say JPEGs instead, we'll stick with that. And so all these, but still had this idea, like, what could I implement in HTML that would be backwards compatible to links? And so there were a bunch of people were up, they were drinking and talking about, well, what can you do if it's only in text? And somebody joked, well, the only thing you could do is you could just like flash the text. You could have a blink tag and we could implement that. So he stays up late, actually implements it kind of as a joke. And so people come in the next day and on the computer and look what I've got, a blink tag. And we're like, that sounds great. Let's deploy it. And out it goes. So basically because of him and staying up late drinking and kind of a joke, the internet got the blink tag, the much hated blink tag. The whole thing was really fascinating. So I didn't really know the history of this before, hadn't heard of this person. And there's a bunch of things on this site with little write-ups like that. And so we'll link to the blink tag one. But once you're there, click on the top and you can go back to the main menu and you see Lou's other things. He did the amazing fish cam, which was the second ever live camera on the web pointing at his fish tank. Just things like that, like really fascinating early web things, all written up in a very personal way. So highly recommended. And if you hate the blink tag, which you should, then he's the fellow to blame. And you can read all about it.
That's wild.
Cool.
I don't know how you found this, but...
Somebody mentioned something about the blink tag and it was a link to something else that linked to this. And I was like, what is this treasure trove of wonder? So yeah, it's awesome.
Wow. And I completely agree with you that you should hate the blink tag, but this, you know, maybe gives a little bit of closure, understanding where it came from.
Well, one of the nice things is, like, if when you're on his page and he talks about his things, like the amazing fish cam, which links over to fishcam.com, which is currently still live and active. So, like, you can go on and see, like, I guess it's now just showing older photos from the fish cam, maybe not. Oh, no, June 23rd. It's currently a live camera right now, just done in static photos. So this fish cam, it's still live. Like, there's so many links from here that go to really interesting things. So fascinating site, and I look forward to exploring it.
The fish are moving. It's not video. It is a bunch of static pictures, you know, so it's like...
Yeah. Because I remember setting up cams like that as well, that you couldn't really stream anything live. So what it did was take photos every 5 or 10 seconds and stick them in a directory that would then get uploaded to replace the existing one on a web page. So I'm sure that's how this is running. And it's still running since 1994.
Very excellent.
Yep.
Nice. Nice fish.
Well, Paul, I think you had the closing item here. Something about a YouTube video. Oh, and by the way, just to correct the record, I disparage Alan Kay. Sorry, Alan. It wasn't he who said this terrible basic quote. It was Edsger Dijkstra who said, "It is practically impossible to teach good programming to students that have had a prior exposure to BASIC. As potential programmers, they are mentally mutilated beyond hope of regeneration."
Nice.
Yeah. So yeah. Thankfully not too extreme. Anyway, sorry, Paul, yes. Your video.
So this is actually a sort of, I guess my other one was also just kind of an update on something we mentioned before. So the 8-bit symphony came and went. It was at Hull City Hall on June 15th and 16th. And so it was basically, and I'm trying to remember even the details of it. It was essentially like Commodore 64 themed, you know, video game music played by a symphony orchestra. And so there is a video that has, I think it's the whole thing. So a video record of this, if you couldn't be there at the time, you can see it. There's some kind of protection on it that is such that it will stop being available after about a couple of weeks. And if you go to the c64audio.com site, you can find out how you can get the program in a full download to keep. So this is for you to sample, but there's going to be one that you can get, presumably supporting the event. So it looks, when we mentioned it before, I thought it looked interesting. I have not actually sat and listened to it now, but it is available, and it's a cool idea. So
yeah, I've kind of clicked through spots of the video a little bit. So the video is footage of Commodore 64 games. And I guess the music is synced up with it in some way or another, but I have to save that until after we're done talking. Can we finish up talking, you guys? I want to listen to this thing.
All right. Yeah, to start off with an introduction that says that this is essentially what this was, I think, shown on the screen at the time. Yeah, so
right.
The people in the venue also saw this stuff.
Looks like you can buy it a couple of ways. You can buy a box set on, I don't know, is it on DVD or what it is? Or you can buy it just as a digital download. Or $9 or £9 or whatever it was.
Excellent.
So.
And there is a.
It's pretty cool.
Like a track list of a sort in the YouTube description that lists basically the. I assume that basically the games that were the inspirations for the music that's being played.
Well, cool. Well, that takes care of the news. And now we've got some computing shows coming up. If you want to actually get out and. Interface with some of your fellow retro computing hobbyists, you can do it. One place you can do it, and this is coming up pretty quick, is at Kansas Fest in Kansas City, Missouri. This is July 16th through the 21st. We'll have that link up in the show notes, kansasfest.org, easy to remember. Another one that's coming up August 3rd and 4th is the Vintage Computer Festival West. This is in Mountain View, California. I imagine it's, again, at the Computer History Museum. Is that right, guys?
Yes.
Nice. And also, another thing coming up in Langenfeld, Germany, is Fujiyama 2019, an Atari-themed thing that actually is a really long festival, August 26th through September 4th. We've mentioned that Kevin Savitz is going to be there, and by saying that, I've also mentioned his name now in this episode, which is a good omen. And Jack, you were saying you might go for part of this also.
Yeah, I think I might. So the 26th to the 4th is actually like a week and 2 days or 3 days. I guess it depends on how you count. So it does stretch over one weekend. I'm thinking about heading down for the weekend that's in the middle of that space, but not confirmed. But we'll see. I would like to. It seems super cool.
Yeah, awesome. And then the next one coming up after that, Tandy Assembly 2019. That's in Springfield, Ohio. It's September 27th through 29th. And with that, we will go to a word from our sponsor.
Out here, we entertain ourselves at home. So we got an Atari video game. There's so many different games to play. We especially like Space Invaders, zapping those little devils from outer space. It's fun, but personally, I think the whole idea of creatures from outer space is a little far-fetched.
No other company offers you as many different video game cartridges as Atari.
And we're back. Did you miss us? That was like a whole 30 seconds. Now let's talk about a retro computing gift idea. And once again, we can talk about Kevin Savitz, because he's made some vintage tech stickers, and they're really cool. One of them, do you guys remember Elephant Brand floppy disks? I remember them fondly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Yes.
Of course.
They were always like the luxury brand.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I think of like Elephant and Dyson, you know.
Dyson, for me, is the super true. Luxury brand for fancy people.
Yeah, those were always like, I remember working computer retail, those babies were $50 a box. So.
I've never had data worth that. Not to this day.
Well, with inflation, that's like $190 today or something, right?
Oh, not a chance.
But anyway, yeah, Elephant Memory Systems stickers and also Beagle Brothers stickers, which Beagle Brothers is like super nostalgia if you're in the Apple II world, right?
Yeah. They were sort of the comedians of the software industry.
Mm-hmm. At the last Kansas Fest, I got a Beagle Brothers bag. I think you got one too, didn't you, Paul?
I did, in fact.
I think you got the nicer one than me, though, with the better handle. I think I cheaped out and I shouldn't have, though I use my bag all the time.
Cool. Yeah. I don't think I have gotten it out since then. I should do that.
I leave it in my car. It's one of my grocery bags. I use it constantly. I love it. Not one person has ever commented.
That's frustrating because it seems like somebody should.
I would think so too. And every once in a while, I'll be like getting groceries and I'll lay it down with the label side up, kind of hoping. No, nothing. Nothing.
Canadians have weird ways of flirting.
Weird flex, but okay. Yeah. Exactly. But no one's ever commented, said anything, nothing.
Uh-huh. Well, this gift is right up my alley because I like the cheaper stuff. So, you know, if you're looking for a gift that's not going to cost you two or three appendages, then these stickers definitely qualify. $5 each, plus $1 shipping per order. So, you know, buy them now, buy them often, is what I say. And with that, we can talk about eBay auctions, because that's yet another example of, you know, a way to spend money and get more stuff in your house, which I think is exactly the opposite of what Carrington's trying to do. And yet, he's got the very first auction.
Yeah, I wouldn't buy it, but I like it. There's certain computers out there that I've never owned, and so I have no nostalgia for them. But I love them in a way that I know if I had owned one, I would have huge nostalgia for them. So the only thing that stops me is the fact that I haven't used it. And one of those is the Franklin Ace 500. I think it's gorgeous. It's a little bit bigger than I'd want maybe a computer to be, but it's just great because it's this dark gray. I think it looks lovely. I love the keyboard in it. I love the size of it, like with the little handle. And I guess you can't put monitors on it, but it looks like you should. And just anyway, I love the size of the keyboard. I love the look of the computer. I just adore them. But they often go for quite a bit. And so here's a nice working one, currently bid up to $165, basically, which would be a good price for this computer. It's got 12 bids, so odds are good it's going to go more than that. But if you have been having your eye out for one of these beautiful computers, here's one. Comes with the box as well, and in working condition, and all the bits, and it looks lovely. I love them.
This is a really nice example of one. It looks like it's in really nice shape.
It has a handle on the back that's sort of reminiscent of the Apple IIc model. Like, it believes it is portable.
Exactly.
It seems a little bit big, but...
They're chunky for a portable computer, but a lot of stuff back then was. But I just dig it a lot. They have RGB interface, like, it's incorporated in them, so you can... It's a nice computer. Like, they frankly made good stuff, and then got sued for it, but I like them.
Right. And the box is included.
Yeah, box looks pretty rough shape, cool. but nice for storage and things, and... It's a really nice version of one that looks very newish and is working, and at the moment doesn't cost a ton of money. If it gets bid up to $900 or something, then probably not worth it. But right now, for $165, if you wanted one, that's a good price.
Well, I don't know the timeline of Franklin Systems, but this one is probably post-lawsuit, right? After they worked out all that stuff? Because I thought they worked it out and then, you know, came out with some models after that. Am I dreaming that up? This is my episode to wildly speculate and not know what the heck I'm talking about. Actually, that's every episode.
Franklin was the one that... I think you're right that Franklin was the one that kind of survived the challenge. They managed to be incompatible enough, you know. I think that's right. Can't remember.
Well, anyway, either way, this thing's gorgeous, and I find it interesting that it's powered by a wall wart, so the power supply guts aren't actually in the computer itself. It's got this ginormous wall wart, 5 volts at 18 amps. Holy cow! That's a lot of amps.
That's a powerful computer.
Power, power.
Nice.
Power, power. My memory of it is very vague about the lawsuit and stuff. I think the 500... And one other one, either the 1,000 or the 2,000 or whatever. I like the 500, though. But came out around the 2C time. And they were the ones that were like the legal ones, like after the big lawsuit. But they had a Franklin Ace 100 and maybe 1,000, something like that, that were the Apple ripoffs or whatever, and so they got sued by Apple and then forced to develop their own operating system that was kind of compatible. Anyway, I just like the 500. I think it's gorgeous.
It is. That's a beautiful machine. All right, I got the next item on eBay here. This is for a vintage Intel EEPROM. And, you know, I don't even really care about the tech specs of this EEPROM. I just picked it because I thought it looked awesome. Like, if alien robots ever invaded the Earth and I stripped the metal off their forehead, this is what I would expect to see underneath.
Earl's the hero we need.
Just at the time we need him, yes. But, I mean, I love these old-style white ceramic chips from back in the day that have the gold pins. It looks very decorative, and it just looks 70s, doesn't it? I mean, I don't know what specific era this is from, if it is in fact 70s or 80s, but just the gold shining off of the white ceramic with the little brains doodad in the middle there. Anyway, so you can have this fine piece of artwork disguised as a chip for $28 on eBay. And there were several of this kind of chip on there. I looked for one that actually had a good picture because apparently these style of chips resist having their picture taken. They're very shy because most of the pictures that I saw of them were incredibly fuzzy, like it was taken with a 1990s digital camera or something like that. But this one, they finally had a good set of photos for it, and I just love it. Although in a couple of these, yeah, it's like these are fuzzy too. So it's like if you take a picture of an EEPROM, apparently you erase it or something like that. Anyway, that's my eBay pick. What do you guys think?
Maybe they're made out of the same stuff that UFOs are made out of. So they're actually like out of focus in real life. So when people take pictures, it's not that they're bad photos. It's just that's what UFOs look like.
Exactly. It's like the comedian Mitch Hedberg said. He was like, it's not the photographer's fault. Bigfoot is fuzzy.
Actually, these look like the kind of chips that would be used in that Tom Selleck movie Runaway, the program the robot spiders to attack people. I'm sure Gene Simmons had a whole collection of these things and used them for evil. So you can use them for evil, too, if you buy this auction.
It's what I'm telling you. These just look like sci-fi chips. So anyway, I love it. I'm not going to buy this specific one, but man, I wish I had one of these old white ceramic chips in my collection because I just think they look cool.
Yep. They are nice looking.
All right, what do you have for us, Paul?
Right. I have a couple of sort of themed things. So in the show notes, I will leave the last Apple Workstation card that was sold on eBay. I mentioned it earlier when we were talking about that. And also an Alpha Smart Dana Wireless, which is that Palm OS sort of like kind of laptop factor thing. They're both pretty cool. Both can connect to wireless. I guess they're both sort of networking things. The Dana is the Palm OS wireless capable thing. I will not talk about those further. For some reason I went on, I think there was an Epson PX8 that was somewhere listed, and took me on a little bit of a Epson PX8 kick, here. But so I will first start with, the PX8 set, because I thought that was kind of interesting. It's expensive. So it's a $300 buy it now, but it looks nice. It has this disk drive, which I forgot the name of it now. Or the number of it.
PF10?
But PF10, that's it. ASC, there's a manual for it. These things are relatively obscure. It's pretty hard to find those.
They're unobtainium, yeah.
And what's cool about this set is, I mean, so first of all, if you were looking for that disk drive, that might almost account for half this price. But it also has, you know, it looks like it's in good shape. It has nice, you know, manuals and binders. It has actually a bunch of manuals a disk for the floppy drive, and a couple of software ROMs and some cassettes and things. It's a pretty complete and well cared for set. If you are looking for a nice one, this isn't so bad. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree. Yeah. And being able to get a hold of a PF10 would be awesome. There are emulators for it, obviously. I think we've talked about that on this show, and I've blabbed on about it in other places. But if you want the actual real deal, then, you know, they don't come up very often.
Yeah, so this is it sort of jumped out at me because of that. I mean, this seller actually has a number of things that are in the kind of vintage computer realm and has sort of managed to perfectly place all of the prices. So you won't impulse buy them. You have to, it's going to hurt a little bit.
You gotta want it.
But it's not, but it's priced about right. I mean, like, it's not quite too much. Unlike the next thing I'm going to mention, which is this one is, it's a new old stock Epson programming software ROM chip pack for the PX8. And I thought it was interesting just because I had never seen the original packaging. This is it's got the little software and manuals for portable WordStar, Calc, and Scheduler, which are the standard things. MicroPro software that came with this thing, I think, or at least, you know, almost every PX8 you get has these. It is not worth whatever it is, $200 to buy it and have it shipped from Budapest, but at any rate, it's still kind of cool to see it in its original form.
Yeah, it's a ton of money for that. I mean, when that outfit in Colorado still had new PX8s in stock, one of the other things that they had was this set, and man, it didn't sell for anywhere near that, but of course those are gone now, so what are you going to do?
And then the last PX8 related thing I thought was actually pretty cool. It is a 3D printed cradle for the ROMs. So in the back of the PX8, there's a place where you can put like the software, you know, so WordStar or whatever, and they come in little ROMs. And I always kind of wondered, you know, like it would be kind of cool to be able to burn your own and stick it in there. But of course there's a sort of like a plastic piece, thing that they sit in. And so this is a 3D printed such a thing that you could get. You can get a pack of two and they fit in a PX8 or PX4.
This is one of the coolest things I've seen in, I don't know, ever. This is so awesome that, because like you say, you can add your own software, you could burn a ROM, you could put it in there, but where are you going to get the little cradles? And the other thing that I hope is that the design for this is up on Thingiverse or some other 3D site where you could order your own too. I mean, in case you can't find one for sale on eBay, it'd be nice to be able to have it printed up at, you know, whatever's your local 3D printer. It'd probably cost you more than what they're selling these for, but still, this is just great. Yeah, I mean, with the PX8, you had it was just basically some chips with their legs bent around a little cradle that you would then insert into it, kind of their answer to a cartridge. Very simplistic, but it works. And having these available now means, you know, you could have a little bit of homebrew fun.
Cool.
Yeah, and particularly for also things that are super hard to get, you know, like if they're super ROMs and things like that. That I don't know if it was for, I don't know if that is the, maybe that's for the Model 100, I forget. But at any rate, they both have the same kind of thing. But it's good, these cradles are good because they protect the pins from bending too.
Yeah, yeah, indeed.
Okay, and then the last thing I'll mention is I came across an auction for, it is an AIM-65 development computer, a Rockwell AIM-65. So, I mean, these things are, I'm trying to think what's, there's something like, they're sort of like a KIM, I guess, right? I believe they're 6502 based, and it's, you know, it's basically just the machinery around the chip to interface with it, to interface it with like a output and a keyboard and stuff like that. But this is in a case that's mounted in a suitcase. It's got, you know, like a little zero insertion force place to put a PROM. And some other stuff, you know, for input and output, and it's enclosed, unlike some of the AIM-65 things that you might at some point come across. It has a little printer and stuff. It appears to be working. It appears to be clean. And it also says, you know, among the other things, it talks about in the description about it, it was it's built into a $300 Zero Centurion Elite case. And it says it is literally indescribable. After which there's some words describing it. but among the things that it says, it's waterproof, it's dropproof, dustproof, shockproof, lifeproof, and EMP proof. And I just wanted to highlight that, that it is EMP proof. So in the event of an EMP disaster, you will still be able to program your 6502.
In the zombie apocalypse, we'll all be on one of these.
That's cool.
This is really awesome. I mean, you always talk about the trainer boards and, you know, they come with this and that. This looks like it's got all the things, including that cool, what looks like a alphanumeric LED display that is awesome looking.
Yeah, it's well taken care of. It's pretty complete.
Very nice find.
I think that is it for me, yes. But that's okay. They were cool, even if they weren't numerous.
They're excellent. And now
I've got one more to throw in, weirdly.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Like, just browsing as we're talking about, and I just noticed this SD Duo Disk floppy disk drive emulator for the Apple II. And I'm not aware of this one. There's so many of these little Apple II cards that you put an SD card in and emulates floppies. There's tons of these. But this is one that's different, and I hadn't encountered before. So it emulates a Duo Disk. But if you look, so it takes two SD cards. So presumably it's emulating like the Duo Disk, the Apple II double disk floppy drive. But this is not a self-contained thing. Like, it's got two ports, two connectors on it that you would connect to the disk II card inside an Apple II. And presumably you then either strap this to something or stick it in the case. Like, I was like, it has two little QC past stickers on it, which makes it look like something came out of a factory. And I'm sure this is just something created by somebody and they had a bunch of QC past stickers. So, okay, cool. Good on you. But I don't know. Have you guys encountered this one before? This was news to me.
I don't think I have. Yeah, it's true. I don't entirely understand how this works.
Yeah, looking at it, it looks like I've got an SD floppy too, and how that works is it's a little self-contained thing, and he just plugs into, you know, one of the ports on a normal disk II card. So this looks like you would just connect both, double. It's weird, and it'll just act as both your drives, and so you got two floppies. Can it switch between things? I don't know. I can't find any other info. I've been Googling about it while we talk, and don't know who makes it. Can't find other info. There's just this one listing on eBay. Says it works, but doesn't show anything about it. I don't know. It's weird. But here's another thing.
Well, follow-up question, Your Honor, because you guys know the Apple stuff. So this connector is what you would see on, like, your older version of Apple drives, not that DB connector that you would see on something like a Unidisc or a Duo Disc, right?
Yeah, if you had an old Apple IIe with just a disk II card in it that you'd connect your floppy drives to, this is the sort of connector it would have. So this thing is pretending to be a Duo Disk, but the Duo Disk just has that one bigger port. So it's using different connectors than the actual Duo Disk would. It even says on it it's for Apple II clone. Doesn't even say it's for a real Apple II. So it's all very strange. Don't know who makes it. It's $90. Has 19 people watching it, but nobody's bit so far. Just the one available, as far as I can tell. It comes from China. I know no other info.
Yeah. It's very strange, because there definitely are other emulators that will plug into both of the things on the Disk II card so that it would sort of handle both Disk I and Disk II. I'm trying to remember what Unisdisk, I think, did this. This really just seems like two disk emulators on a single PCB.
That's why I think I agree. Like, I think that's what this is. And so that's just as good as a Duo Disk, I guess. But I don't see why this has any advantage over, like, say, a floppy Emu or something. Like, this has no display. I don't know if it can switch floppies easily. Or do you just have one floppy image on each SD card and you physically swap them or something? I don't know. It's yet another one of these, and I'd never seen it before. So it caught my eye. Figured we'd throw it into the show notes.
Sure. Maybe somebody can respond with feedback about how great these are, or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Two closing discussions, I will say. And Carrington, you have the first one on that section.
Okay, back to me. Little, very, very quick things that weren't newsworthy, but just I found interesting. On Imgur, I guess it's pronounced Imgur, whatever, there's a little video of a mechanical binary counter. And it's just, it's a lovely way to implement this. So if you want to see binary counting up, and somebody just flips little digits with their finger and it physically moves them, zero on one side, one on the other, and flips them over. It's just lovely. It's binary. It's not complicated, but this is just a neat way to visualize it, and I found it fascinating to watch this little video.
So
I'll link
to
that.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah. Super fun. And speaking of like beginning stuff, if you want to become a software developer, you're interested in programming, but you've got no background in it at all, and you don't have any time to go and take a comp sci degree, there's a podcast for you, and I find it fascinating and lovely and adorable, and I mean, it's super basic, but really interesting. It's called the Base.cs podcast, and I highly recommend it. So there's this thing called Base.cs, which Vaidehi is her name. This lady named Vaidehi writes these articles about just like, you know, what's an algorithm, and here are specific algorithms. How do you sort things? What are the various ways you sort them, and how do you pick a sorting algorithm? And what are various comp sci problems? How do you count in binary? Like just really, really basic things written up really well. So that's the Base.cs blog. I didn't really follow it because it's also pretty basic. But what's adorable is Vaidehi has a friend who is a computer person. Like she does web development or something like that all the time, but doesn't have a computer degree. And was always interested in that. So Vaidehi is walking her through like the stuff you would get from a comp sci degree that you might not get if you just went into programming. And so they start really, really basic, like what is binary algorithms, that sort of thing. And they've been going on. They're currently in season 6. And it's just these two ladies with great personalities talking about this stuff. Not very long shows. And they kind of group them in seasons of 8 or 10 episodes, I think, something like that. I just burned through them and they're just lovely. I just absolutely highly recommend this stuff. So even if you know it, they're just so entertaining. It's worth listening to them talk about how to count in hex. Like it just, cause it, they're just two pals talking about comp sci stuff and it's really, really good. And it's not, you know, our podcast. It's not just a bunch of dudes talking about things. So it's so nice to hear a different voice and it's really well produced. Highly recommended. So it's base.cs. Available wherever you get podcast stuff. I'm hooked. Totally hooked on it.
Nice. That yeah. Looks really cool.
So that's what I got.
You also made a cable, you said.
I did, yes. My girlfriend, she lives in Canada, you wouldn't know her. Woohoo! Got to bring her up again. She has cats, and the cats like to chew cables, as they do, so her internet went out because they chewed through the power cable and through her little phone cable that connects to the modem and through the Ethernet cable that goes from the modem to her like Wi-Fi. It's like, holy
moly.
It sounds
actually pre-planned.
It totally does. It was like a heist, little cat burglars. So I was over at her place this morning, and I'm like, I can fix this. I can totally fix these. It's wires. And if somebody doesn't work with wires and you can just like step up and do cable repair, it looks so much more impressive than it really is. So I got to really impress somebody today by making new cables and crimping new ends on Ethernet cable, which is super simple. But I guess if you've never done it, it looks impressive. So if you need to impress people with something that's actually easy to do, I highly recommend making cables in front of them.
Good tip.
That is way cool on so many levels. And yeah, I've got a couple new kittens in the house here, and definitely shoo them away when they get toward the phone charging cables and stuff like that.
These aren't new. They're like 2.5. They're just little monsters. They're adorable, but come on.
you gotta shoo them away from the cables when they're young. That's what we've done with all of our cats, and by and large, it's worked. You know, knock on wood.
Higher voltage in some of the cables. You know,
that can work too. It, you know, it, there are other consequences than that, but okay. Well, Paul, parting shots. What do you got?
Well, yeah. Somehow, all this time that was supposed to materialize has yet to materialize, but we're getting actually pretty close. I think we're within a month now of when Kansas Fest is. I have two things I'm supposed to present. Neither one is prepared. But
it's actually like 3 weeks.
Oh, you got plenty of time.
Yeah. Well, there's a plane I have to take on the way there. I can always work on the plane. But yeah, no, it's pretty interesting. Both of the things I'm talking about are I'm interested to learn about them. I don't know anything about them ahead of time though. So one of them, I think I may have mentioned it before, but there was a book called Beneath Apple DOS that was written by Don Worth and Peter Lechner, I think his name is, and it was a very big reference manual. You know, it's very detailed about how the workings of the disk operating system, and that Don Worth also was responsible for a game called Beneath Apple Manor, and I have his notes. So I have scanned his notes, and I was planning on kind of going through like the you know, whatever the notes that have to do with the creation of Beneath Alpha Manor and whatever there is about the book. And the thing is, I don't know the game. I don't think I've played Beneath Alpha Manor before. So that's one problem, is that I can't recognize what's here. So I have stuff to do between now and then, but I think it's going to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that's what's going on with me.
Cool.
More mad preparation and no lazy summer.
That's okay. No rest for the wicked. And so what about you, Jack?
Oh, I don't really have too much interesting. I've been too, I don't know. What is my deal? I haven't been doing much retro computing stuff at all lately. I still have this like thought that, man, I'm going to take some of my spare time and I'm going to get good at 6502 assembly this year. Like, I think this, you've heard this before. And I,
from myself,
you're like Cold Fusion. You're always 10 years away.
Yeah. It's always just around the corner, but yeah, that's all I got.
Well, we're rooting for you, man.
Thank you.
And so I guess I'll close out here. So I've been playing with a new FPGA board that I got. It's called Tiny FPGA, and it is both an FPGA and Tiny as advertised. So I have a more expensive and really cool FPGA board from a company called Digilent. Love the board, love the fact that it can do a bunch of stuff, but one of the downsides is it can do a bunch of stuff. It's really complex. I mean, it's FPGA combined with a dual core ARM that connects with each other via a complicated protocol and blah, blah. And I've learned a lot from it, but man, it's like staring up at a, you know, just a sheer cliff face when you're trying to learn all this stuff. So I wanted to downshift into something more simple and come at it from that angle. So Tiny FPGA does that for me. It's a smaller FPGA from a company called Lattice, much more simple in design, so you could wrap your head around it a little bit more easily. One of the other things that I love about some of the boards that are that use the FPGAs from this company called Lattice is that there's open source tool chains for them. So another thing that put me off about the more expensive board that I have is the tool chain is this ginormous, I'm not kidding when I say 20 plus gigabytes worth of stuff that you have to install to actually, I know, it's like FPGAs have not caught up with mainstream software dev in terms of their software packages. They're typically heavy, super encumbered with a bunch of proprietary IP. You know, it's like it just makes you mental. Whereas these simpler FPGAs from Lattice, they have open source tool chains for the whole nine yards, all the way from taking the design language straight to the bits that you spin out to the FPGA to actually do the programming of it, which I think is really cool and has the other advantage that open source stuff churns fast and is often a lot more lightweight. Like just a simple thing that I wanted to do on my more complicated board could take a couple minutes to compile and spit out the bits, whereas the same comparable design on this new board that I got takes seconds, literally seconds, to just you hit the build button and bang, it's done. The first time I couldn't believe it. I was like, "What? It can't be done already. What are you talking about?" But it really was. Downloaded it to the board and it worked. I was like, "Oh, I'm going to like this." So anyway, still trying to learn about FPGAs, trying to, take a little bit smaller bite with this particular board. And I love it because it's only $39. I mean, I could even blow it up. And, I'm not gonna, hopefully, fingers crossed. But if I did, it's not a gigantic tragedy, right? So anyway, that's my deal.
Yeah, that was the thing that struck me, is that I think of FPGA as being an expensive thing. And I assume the logic cells row here is the one that sort of says like how much oomph it has, and it has 7680, Jack Nuttings of oomph or whatever.
But yes, logic cells
that was completely opaque. I before we started recording, We doesn't really matter. I should probably not even say that.
No, it's all good. We were just talking about how in Canada, jacknutting is now a standard unit of measurement.
Yes, but it's a measurement of mass, or apparently now, oomph.
Apparently of oomph. This is the nonsense we chat about before we start recording.
I think these are the things we should absolutely capture for the show. So
I assume the $38 one is less powerful than these super expensive ones, but I would so much rather just play around with a $38 thing.
Exactly. Totally. And, you know, logic cells and internal RAM are a couple of the measures of complexity of a FPGA, and you're totally right that this has less than a pricier FPGA, but comes with the, you know, the compensation of having less complexity so you could actually understand it, and also less cost. And, like, if you were to build some sort of retro project around an FPGA, you want to try and hit the exact right price point that, you know, will not be too much for a retro project, but will have enough logic cells, internal RAM, other doodads. And they do have doodads. They have like phase lock loop to get exact frequencies. You know, some of them have hardware multipliers, which is kind of think the equivalent of, you know, like an 8087 chip, right? Like a numeric coprocessor, but that kind of stuff built in. And this has some of those, it doesn't have some of those. That's all okay, because I'm still like totally in learning mode.
Yeah. Well, maybe when I'm done with all my project preparation, I will get one of these and play with it.
Yep, it's fun. You can make a light blink and understand exactly why, like down to the gate level, why the stinking light is blinking, which I love having that visibility. But anyway.
Stinking blinking lights.
Yes. Yes. So I've talked too much, and, you know, I already realize that episode 195 will have to just be the errata for all the things I goofed up in episode 194. So sorry for that. I need a fact checker. Anybody want to volunteer? And that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us and other things, many other things, retro, at the VC Fed forums, www.vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. It rolls right off the tongue. And that's operated by the Vintage Computer Federation. Awesome group of folks. You can find RCR on Twitter, at RCR Podcast. We're there. We tweet. You can join our Facebook group, which has hundreds and hundreds of folks talking about fun retro stuff. That's on Facebook, which is cool because it's a Facebook group. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We love feedback. Love to hear things from folks. We didn't talk about all the, for instance, mention all the things that Klaus had included in his email, but I just loved that email and hearing about all the things that he's done, interested in. So if you want to send us feedback, man, we read it all. We are a member of the Throwback Network. Link for that up in the show notes. If you like us, please write a review for our show on iTunes. It helps boost our ego. And until next time,
Retro Confused.